KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Sunnyvale, California.
Oakland, California.
Oakland, California.
North Oakland.
North Oakland.
North Berkeley.
South Berkeley.
Adams Point.
Yosemite.
Coming up, we'll hear about a state bill that's being called the most controversial housing proposal in decades.
This is a giveaway to landlords and developers without asking anything in return for a city and community.
Then, from San Quentin Radio, we'll hear from incarcerated men who found their calling as barbers for fellow inmates.
Usually when I'm out there cutting hair, everybody's get a crowd standing around over there watching and talking.
And we'll head down to San Jose to learn about the Persian New Year's Zoroastrian origins.
And it's not the name Zoroastrianism or Zoroaster really that matters. It's the philosophy itself that's valuable.
That's coming up today on Cross Currents. Yesterday, the San Francisco Board of Supervisors decided to formally oppose a state bill. It's being called the most controversial housing bill in decades. The transit-rich housing bonus, if passed by the state legislature, would force cities and counties to allow for dense and tall housing near public transit, no matter what local laws say. Okay, KALW's housing reporter Liza Veal is here to tell us what this bill could mean for the Bay Area and why San Francisco leaders have put up such a fight against it. Liza, this bill has actually gotten quite a lot of attention all over the place.
Yeah, it's gotten a lot of national coverage. The New York Times called it a bold, divisive plan. And locally, it's brought out a really big clash.
Start doing some research. Look into who actually get those homes. Look actually who's behind the bill.
Yesterday, there were dueling protests outside City Hall. There was shouting and name-calling. It got pretty vicious. Signs were slapped down to the ground. The supporters of the bill were called white supremacist colonizers for shouting over the folks that were speaking out against the bill, some of whom were elderly, immigrant, low-income families.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's this bill about that's so contentious?
Okay, so this bill is trying to kill two birds with one stone. It wants to make housing more affordable by making it easier to build and ease the shortage. And secondly, it wants to lower greenhouse gas emissions by building that new housing near public transit in order to wean people off driving.
Both of those seem like pretty desirable outcomes. How would it accomplish those?
Okay, so it changes zoning laws. Right now, cities only allow for tall apartment buildings and condos in certain parts of the city. Think about how most of the west side of San Francisco is small single-family homes, mm-hmm. or North Oakland, or basically all of Marin County. They're zoned to prohibit denser, taller development. Usually because that's the kind of neighborhood that residents want to preserve.
Yeah, it preserves that character.
Exactly. But so this bill would override those rules in areas near transit. So housing built within a half mile of a train stop or a quarter mile of a frequent bus stop would be exempt from most local zoning rules.
Which actually encompasses a whole lot of many of these neighborhoods because they're close to bus lines or train lines.
Yeah, I mean, analysis done by the city of San Francisco found that 90% of the city's residential parcels would be affected by the bill, meaning that their zoning restrictions would be replaced by the bill's sort of one size fits all. So higher height limits, no more CEQA environmental review, no parking requirements. The bill in its current form gets rid of a lot of things that are obstacles to building, everything except affordability requirements. If those are in the local zoning, they would still apply.
Mm-hmm. Well, so groups like SPUR, San Francisco Planning and Urban Research, that advises the city in a lot of ways, I mean, they're really for dense growth. So it's as probably a good policy, right?
Yes, but so the thing is, San Francisco has spent years painstakingly crafting a plan for more density in a way that maximizes community benefits. Mm-hmm. So they say, we'll allow for X more stories on your building if you provide X additional affordable housing. That's additional to even the citywide requirements.
And this is actually something that Supervisor Katie Ting and former Mayor Ed Lee were working on before this came about.
And they finally came to a plan, but then under SB 827, that density bonus plan would be moot. And other cities that don't even have those plans, or maybe don't even have affordability requirements, they can still use zoning as a tool of leverage. So they can say, okay, we'll give you a height limit exemption if you throw in some affordability, but that leverage disappears when zoning restrictions disappear.
So if you end up losing some of these community benefits, then you have the raising of the concern about gentrification, which is obviously a big concern in the Bay Area. I'm picturing that if it suddenly becomes easier to build luxury condos that are tall and dense in places where it was impossible or at least hard,
yeah.
then people are worried that those new buildings will displace existing residents.
Yeah. So there are actually very strong tenant protections in this proposal. Developers who plan to demolish a rental unit would have to pay for the moving expenses and cover their rent for 3 years or more. And plus, renters would have the right to move back into the new development at their old rental price. And there's a lot of people who say instead of just opposing this bill, San Francisco should be trying to improve it. You know, there's still time. It's still changing. It's been changing constantly. But so, that's not what the Board of Supervisors did.
Mm-hmm. So those do seem like pretty strong rental protections. But people are still worried that new apartments are going to cause displacement.
Yeah, because new buildings don't just affect the individuals who are directly displaced. They do change the character of the neighborhood. And fancy new condos do tend to attract higher end amenities and raise prices nearby. You know, the whole snowball of gentrification. And
the snowball of gentrification.
And so there's a lot of low income neighborhoods that have transit. You can think of West Oakland or Balboa Park in San Francisco that would be made into targets for developers by this bill.
Because they're on transit lines.
Yeah. And because suddenly it would become possible or at least easier to build big lucrative developments in those areas. Here's how Supervisor Jane Kim put it.
When you give any land 10 more units, you're basically giving that owner more money. This is a giveaway. This is a giveaway to landlords and developers without asking anything in return for a city and community.
That's Supervisor and mayoral candidate Jane Kim. So why is this then considered a solution to the affordable housing crisis?
Ben, this is why the bill activates such a yimby-nimby fault line in the housing world. A lot of people testifying at City Hall in support of the bill argued that, yes, while it's true the new housing tends to make the immediate neighborhood more upscale, it also relieves overall demand. So for the region as a whole, and especially over the long term, it helps keep prices down. The state has these guidelines for how much housing each city should be building, and most cities are behind. So this is a way to force them to build.
Okay, but for the people living in really vulnerable neighborhoods, in the short term, they just might get priced out if all the rents are rising, right?
Yeah, so some people just think that this kind of market-based solution is the wrong approach to solving the housing crisis. Here's Supervisor Aaron Peskin at City Hall yesterday.
I think we should send a message to Sacramento that this dog does not hunt, and let's start over again. And if Sacramento wants to be helpful, help us address the Ellis Act, help us address Costa Hawkins, and send us a bunch of money so we can build more affordable housing.
All right, so that's how Aaron Peskin feels about this. Are there any other objections that you've heard?
Yeah, plenty of other objections are coming from people who live in fancy, exclusive neighborhoods that just don't want to see an influx of new people and traffic and tall buildings blocking their views. And since homeowners tend to vote at much higher rates, representatives tend to vote the way that they want them to. And some of the most vocal opponents come from Marin County. And that state senator that represents that county, Mike McGuire, he actually controls a committee that the bill would have to clear in order to make it to the legislature. So that's a really big hurdle.
And yet, this bill has gotten a lot of attention and clearly has quite a lot of support as a result. What do you think is going to happen with it at this point?
Well, I think it has a long shot, but I do think that the idea isn't going away. I mean, if California wants to meet its climate change goals, which are a 40% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions from 1990 levels by the year 2030, if you followed that, it will have to change the way that we plan cities because cars are still the number one cause of emissions nationally. So we can't cut back on that until we have housing that's well served by public transit.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Liza.
Thank you.
Liza Veal is KALW's housing reporter. Reach out to her at housing@KALW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hannah Baba. Now, let's hear a story from our partners at San Quentin Radio.
San Quentin Radio, bringing you informative educational stories from the inside out.
In order to make something grow, you got to own a little dirt.
You don't tell, you see what goes on.
Because I like to be free. I like to move about the land.
You could hear a pin drop, and all of a sudden, you heard this.
Getting a haircut can make a person feel good. For the men in San Quentin, it's no different. Some of the barbers are paid to cut hair. Others volunteer to do so. And it can be a complex process, but it's important in the prison environment. Incarcerated reporter Luke Calandris produced this story.
Hi, my name is Bo Gentry. I'm a barber in San Quentin State Prison. I've been a barber for about 35 years in prison.
My name is Rasan Thomas, and I moonlight as a jailhouse barber. I'm not officially assigned. I have my own clippers that I purchased from a package company, and this allows me to go around and cut hair.
My name is Lorenzo Miller, and I'm a barber in North Block. I am assigned. I've been cutting hair for over 35 years.
I enjoy my job. It just relaxes me. I enjoy it. I have fun with it. I'm a very sociable person, so I make people laugh when they sit in my chair, and I pick on everybody, and they all love it. Usually when I'm out there cutting hair, everybody's get a crowd standing around over there watching and talking. And that's how I got a rapport with everybody in my building.
It's fun being there because you hear the important things. You hear a lot of laughter, good stories, funny jokes.
Shower nights are Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. And those are the days that I cut most of the heads that I do. They come up and tell me they need a haircut, and I schedule them right then for that night or the next night or however it works out. I don't cut black hair because if I did, nobody else would come and sit in my chair. That's always been a thing throughout the prison system. When I was on the streets, I cut black hair. I go along with that, and it doesn't cause any problems. We got our black barber in the building. He's a good guy. I've known him for a long, long time, and he's a good barber. He does his thing. And even though I don't cut the brothers' hair, they're all my friends too. They cut right next to me. We pick and joke with each other the entire time.
We have four barbers and only three chairs, but we share. When nobody's working, the other one comes in and does his thing.
One of the worst situations that I remember was when I was up in High Desert. I was the barber up there. All of a sudden, somebody started fighting around me. I locked my stuff in my box real quick because it would have got all crazy, right, if they would have got a hold of my tools.
One day, a guy that was going home, he didn't want me to cut his hair. He wanted one of his friends to do it. And that wasn't a good idea because his friend didn't know how to cut. So his friend messed up his hair. And he got so mad that he took the clippers and slammed them on the ground and broke them. And I felt offended because I'm like, you're going home and you broke the clippers. What about us? So I was very disappointed about that. And we ended up fighting behind that. I ended up beating him up before he went home. So I took cutting hair a little bit too seriously back then.
I was at another prison, Ironwood, and I was cutting hair. And somebody distracted me, talking to me, and I forgot I had the triple zero on, and I was just gonna clean up his little high top fade he had, and I wasn't paying attention, and he looked at me, and it was like no, and I said yeah, and we took it all down. He was mad at me, but he got over it. I just had one that looked like he was riding a motorcycle backwards. His afro was tore up.
I convinced the homeboy that I was a barber, that I really knew what I was doing, and he allowed me to cut his hair, and I had no training at all, and I messed it up. Matter of fact, he wanted a design in the back of his head, and somehow I ended up putting an R, so he was running around with an R, a big giant R in the back of his head, and his name starts with a T. Oops. What you mean, oops? When I first got here, I was cutting a lot of hair. My reputation for a barber has grown. I'm actually pretty good right now, especially when it comes to fades and tapers. I got so overwhelmed with cutting hair. So many friends here, so many people would come to me, and my desire now is to be a writer, so I had to cut them all. They're still mad at me to this day, and there's like 5-10 people that just won't let me not be their barber. They just come everywhere with these. I say, don't come to me on me unless it's an emergency, and they have an emergency every week. My mother's coming. She's coming to visit. I swear to God, she's coming Saturday. You got to cut my hair. So I end up cutting more hair than I'm supposed to because I'm supposed to be focusing on my writing. But I do enjoy cutting hair. It's just I like writing more, and I still try to find a way to do both.
There are times that you're just burnt out. You're tired, and they're still coming, you know, because that visit's for the weekend, and you still have to take the time out and say, hey, I got to get you right for your kids, for your wife, for your parents. You know, we want to make sure you're looking nice, you're looking groomed, because we don't need them to think you're stressing out. To me, that's the reward, to see somebody looking real cool.
That piece was produced by Luke Calandris. San Quentin Radio is a project in which KALW editors train inmates to report stories from inside prison. San Quentin officials listened to and approved the script and audio for the story prior to broadcast. Thanks to Sam Robinson and Larry Schneider for their help. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hana Baba. We all know the Middle East is the birthplace of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. But did you know it's home to an even older religion? Zoroastrianism is a monotheistic faith that began in ancient Iran more than 3,000 years ago. It was the dominant religion during three Persian empires. But since then, the global population has dwindled to a little over 100,000 followers, according to the Federation of Zoroastrian Associations of North America. About 10,000 of those people live in the U.S., and the Bay Area is a hub for the community. In fact, there's a Zoroastrian temple in San Jose. It's one of only eight across all of North America. Right now marks the end of when people celebrate Persian New Year, or Nowruz. KALW reporter Asal Asanapur celebrates with her Iranian family. She decided to learn more about who the modern-day Zoroastrians are, since they represent the origins of her own cultural traditions.
It's the first day of spring. I'm welcomed by the smell of fresh herbs as I walk through the door. My entire family is scattered around the house, where orange tulips bloom everywhere. We're here to celebrate the Persian New Year, Nowruz, which translates to New Day. We gather together for a feast of Persian foods like herb, rice, and fish. As my cousin gives her niece new money, a customary gift.
Happy New Year!
The customs of Nowruz are shared by people of all faiths in Iran and its diaspora. Muslims, Jews, Christians, Baha'is. But its rituals actually come from Zoroastrianism, one of the oldest religions in the world. The day after Nowruz, I find myself in Palo Alto, washing my face with rose water. I love rose water.
Oh, you do? Then let me give you some.
I actually do. I have a little spray of it in my purse.
No way.
I do. I've just arrived at the home of Nilu Farhad.
I was born and raised in Iran, and I am Zoroastrian by birth.
Now, Nilu doesn't consider herself a very observant Zoroastrian, but she believes in the spirit of Nowruz. What you do on the new year carries you through the rest of the year.
That's where the Zoroastrian part, at least for me, comes. You think well, you speak well, you behave well.
Like many Iranians, she follows certain traditions every year, like creating the customary altar, called a half-seen table.
Fixing up the table for you so that it looks good for you.
This beautiful half-seen table.
Yeah, it's part of our half-seen.
Half-seen means seven S's, and each of the items on the table start with a S sound.
Sib, which means apple, symbolizes health. Serke, which is vinegar, it symbolizes age and maturity.
The half-seen table reflects wishes for the year to come. Its roots stem back to the number seven and the Zoroastrian creation story. But the table isn't a mandated practice. People of all religions include their own books of worship, like the Torah, Bible, or Quran. Some Iranians even include Sufi poetry as a symbol of their personal ideology. Nilu says that inclusivity is what Nowruz, or Persian New Year, is all about.
And I think that's why it survived so long, is because it is not tied to one religion.
But it all originated with Zoroastrianism. Persian kings like Darius popularized the holiday, which created a tradition of celebration across countries like modern-day Afghanistan, Turkey, and of course, Iran. Today, Nowruz is regarded as both religious and secular. Religious in that Zoroastrians are expected to clean their houses and go to the fire temple. But it's secular in that even the non-observant get together with family for celebratory meals. Every year at the beginning of spring, hundreds of local Zoroastrians gather in San Jose, where the Persian Zoroastrian organization hosts a party in honor of the new year.
My name is Khashayar Anushe. I go by Kashi here in the U.S. Easier to pronounce.
Kashi moved to the Bay Area in the early 80s, back when there were just a handful of Zoroastrians here. As the community's grown, he's tried to preserve its teachings.
Thoughtfulness. The core thing is education and progress and understanding of your surroundings.
Some call Zoroastrianism more of a philosophy than a religion. It's reflective. There's no official day of worship. And therein lies an obstacle to preserving the culture.
It could work both ways. It definitely could work both ways.
Kashi says that on the one hand, it's good to have progressive thinkers who make independent choices.
But from the perspective of, you know, trying to get the community mobilized to do something, no. That one is, it gets tougher. Because everybody's going to have their own ideas.
At the party, I watch people greet each other with a kiss on each cheek before the kids lead a prayer to ring in the new year. A little girl approaches the dance floor, absorbed in Persian dance. The party is set to go on like this until midnight. While the Persian Zoroastrians were celebrating Saturday night, the Parsis were having a Nowruz party of their own.
The Iranians like to have music and dancing, but the Parsis are more interested in their food.
Now, the Parsis also practice Zoroastrianism, but come from India and Pakistan, where they settled after leaving Iran sometime between the 7th and 10th century.
Hi, my name is Nazneen Shpleet, and I was born in Karachi, Pakistan.
Nazneen is the former president of Zartoshti Anjuman of Northern California, the Parsi organization here in the Bay. Parsi literally means from Persia in Gujarati, but with a recent migration to North America, Iranian Zoroastrians and Parsis have come together for the first time in over 1,000 years.
They were different and yet they were alike.
Different language, different food, different culture.
Then when we go back to see a little bit of the culture, we say, oh, we always used to eating this dish, but we can now see that the origins did come from Iran.
Nazneen says the convergence of communities here in North America allows the next generation of Zoroastrians to come together. They even share a temple in San Jose. So while different languages once divided them, English can bridge that divide. And since the Zoroastrian community is so small, so scattered, this reunion feels even more important.
And now, of course, everyone is worried that the population is dying and dwindling, but all these tales of maybe just overblown.
Though the worldwide Zoroastrian population is shrinking, the Bay Area numbers have grown, especially in job-rich Silicon Valley. Jamshid Varza noticed this growth back in 1996, but found there wasn't a single place his kids could learn about their Zoroastrian heritage.
It was one morning we were at breakfast table talking with Mitra.
Mitra is Jamshid's wife.
The kids would go to school and they would see the friends go to church, go to synagogues, and they said, so what are we? And they had no idea.
So Jamshid and Mitra started a Zoroastrian school.
The first class we had probably 8 or 9, but after the first year, the second year, I had 44 students.
Turns out students loved it, and eventually it brought Zoroastrians of all ages together.
All parents, grandparents, extended family, people coming from overseas because they wanted to be together.
The classes still exist, but not under the Varzas. Since then, Jamshid's been producing documentaries on Zoroastrianism. He also helped start Stanford's Zoroastrian Lecture Series, which became a department that lasted 6 years. Jamshid and Mitra say these efforts have given the next generation a feeling of belonging.
Just a sense of, so this is what we believe. This is what my ancestors believed. This is where I come from. This is what they did. This is how it all happened.
Mitra says education does more than bring Zoroastrian kids back to their roots. Traditions like Nowruz inspire regrowth. It's the celebration of life, of what sustains us.
You just felt it wasn't just the nature having a rebirth, but it was everything having a rebirth. And that sense of renewal was magical.
magical for everyone, since after all, the beauty of Nowruz is that it extends to anyone who wishes to celebrate, whether you're Zoroastrian or not. In San Jose, I'm Asal Asanipour for Cross Currents.
Asal is a current fellow in KALW's Audio Academy, a 9-month training intensive for aspiring radio journalists. Are you interested in applying for next year's cohort? Head to our website, kalw.org, to find out more. Our team includes Janae Darden, Raquel Maria Dillon, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Truk Nguyen, Andrew Stelzer, and Josh Wilson. Our engineers are James Rollins, Gabe Graben, and Jackie Sajiko. The line producer is Liza Veal, with help from Hannah Kingsley-Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Right now, you're listening to San Francisco grunge band Milk for the Angry. They perform at the Corner Store in Berkeley tomorrow night. The show starts at 8:30 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Treffer.